Oh, welcome everyone. It is great to be able to sit up here and look at all your smiling faces, especially Mike over there. Great to see you, Mike. For those of you who weren't here last week, you may be wondering, why in the world are we going through the 12 steps? And there's a very good reason. And the main reason is, every single one of us is recovering from something. Can we all agree on that? We're all recovering from something. Nobody gets out of childhood unscarred, unscathed. Something conspires to let us know that we are not the center of the universe, that our needs will not always be met, that people around us will fail us and betray us and just generally not be there at times. And that fear causes us to try to figure out how to cope, how to survive, how to deal with life. And those childhood things and strategies that we put in place don't just go away when the circumstances change. They follow us through life. And those are our pathologies. And some of the things that we put in place to numb the pain, to help us to cope, are our addictions. And addictions are not just substance abuse. It's not just alcohol and drugs. Our addictions can be anything that we are clinging to that helps us to survive. Anything that we are clinging to that helps give us a sense of some sort of control, some sort of power over our circumstances and our environment. And that power, that seeming power that we hold on to, is what is keeping us from the deepest and most profound expression of an experience with our God. And that is what we need to recover from. And the way that we recover from it is to replace the fear that is at the core of our being when we leave childhood with the perfect love that God has to offer. Because the opposite of fear is not courage. The opposite of fear is perfect love. And once we can apprehend that, then everything really does start to change in our lives. And the 12 steps are a perfect expression of a path through, a way through the recovery process. And it really can be generalized. It comes from the New Testament directly in the first place. And you can pretty much see one-to-one as each step goes by how it relates, how it connects with the teachings of Jesus. And so what we want to do is go through the 12 steps, but in an open way, so that we can see that there is something that we can do. The worst thing that can happen with our faith, the worst thing that can happen with any sort of counseling strategy or anything that we think is going to help us get through the obstacles and the problems in our lives, is to leave them in our heads. Once, as long as they stay in our heads, they cannot do any good in our lives. They have to move from our heads down to our hands and feet and actually inform the choices that we make and all of the actions that we perform. Until that happens, there is no experience of the trustworthiness of God that allows us to trust Him. And so this is what is wonderful about the 12 steps in the way that they're constructed. The first three, the ones we're going through right now, are the retooling of our brains, the thinking in a new way, the renewing of our minds, as Paul would call it. The setting of a whole new worldview, a whole new ground of being that enables us to go through the next eight steps, steps 4 through 11, which are the actual things that we can do to take us through a recovery process that actually does change the nature and quality of our relationships. And it's interesting that the number is 8. You know what the number, symbolic number of 8 from ancient times is? It's the number of rebirth. Pretty cool, huh? 8 steps in the middle there. And then the 12th step is the step of the spiritual awakening and the ability then to be able to go back to the community and give back to them, to be a mentor, now to be a teacher, where the student becomes the teacher. And so in these first three steps that we're looking at right now, they work as sort of a unit, if you think about it. The first step is, as we talked about last week, it's not the giving up of power. It's giving up the illusion that we have any power to begin with. Because we don't have any power over our circumstances. From the smallest things in life, we talked about Jesus telling us we can't turn one hair white or black. We can't add an inch to our height or an hour to our lives. Those most basic things we can't control. We have no power over. The only thing that we have power over is our ability to make a choice. And we can choose a different path once our mind has become clear enough to see that a different choice needs to be made. Until we have that awareness, nothing else happens. But that admission of our powerlessness, you know, that willingness to go forward is what allows us then to come to the second step, step two, which is coming to believe that there is a power greater than ourselves. And it's phrased that way in AA for a very specific reason, to allow anybody to come in. For us, that power greater than ourselves has a name and has a face. We call him God. We call him Jesus. We call him Holy Spirit. Have you ever thought about your belief in God? Now, because you're sitting here, I assume that you do believe in God, or that you say you believe in God. There may be some of you who don't, but it's a pretty good bet that most of you believe in some way, shape, or form in God. But have you ever really examined that belief? Have you thought about what it means to believe in God? Have you explored what it means? Have you ever looked at a word, a printed word on the page? Any word, dog, cat, play, run. You look at the word, and you know this word since your early childhood. You run past it in a sentence at 90 miles an hour as you turn the corner and come back to the next line, and you're reading through. And even if it's just a subliminal blink on a screen, you know, in a TV commercial, you flash the word, you know what it is. But if you stop and you stare at that word long enough, doesn't it start to change and look like something alien or another language or something weird? And all of a sudden you're realizing that you're looking through the familiarity of the word to what it actually is, which is just a string of letters. And even more basic than that, it's just a set of markings on a piece of paper that we have decided means something, that our familiarity has told us means something. Familiarity, easy for me to say, familiarity in and of itself can bring acceptance and meaning. Do you ever think about that? We had to have some plumbing done in our downstairs bathroom because something was leaking from up above and was making bubbles in the paint on the drywall on the ceiling. So we called in a plumber, and he had to cut a hole in the ceiling in order to get up and fix it. So there's a hole about 8 inches across in our bathroom, and God, it looks terrible. You know, but we didn't fix it right away, and after about a month or two, you know what? I don't even see the hole anymore. Marion sees it, but I don't even see the hole. It doesn't bother me, you know. Talking about Josh coming over and fixing it for us someday, I don't know. But I don't feel the urgency anymore. I've become familiar with it. Oh, I know we've all had the experience of having a messy house, and, you know, you just don't clean it, you don't clean it, you don't clean it, and, you know, you just walk in and you deal with it until someone's coming over. And then suddenly you see every single thing as if you're seeing it with their eyes as they walk in the door, and then you're running around like a mad person trying to clean it up. Familiarity. Familiarity can really blind us and stop us from going further, because when something is so familiar, we think we already know it. But familiarity is not knowing. Familiarity is just familiarity. It's just, we can get used to anything, right? Just about anything. And so what we want to do today is to take a look deeper. What does it mean for you to believe in God? What does that even mean to you? You know, the second step has actually two parts. The first part is belief in God. The second part is actually knowing God or trusting God. But taking the first part first, this belief in God, you know, what does it mean to believe in God? Have you actually explored or examined your belief? Is your belief making any visible changes in your life? Has anything changed from before you said you believed in God until after? Are your circumstances better? Are your relationships better? Are your finances better? Are your choices better? Is your life becoming more and more manageable? Is your life becoming more and more Christ-like in terms of the relationships that he had with his friends and the people? Is there any discernible difference? If not, then something really needs to be examined in your life. Because once again, faith is not what we think in our heads, and it's not even what we say with our words. Our faith is what we do with our lives. And if it hasn't gotten down to that level, then we've got a problem. Then we've got to take a look at this. Is what you believe, in other words, really true, or is it just what you believe? Have you posed the question just that way? I love that question. It came from a 17-year-old talking to his father, who was an elder in the church and had taught the boy his particular flavor of Christianity from the cradle on up. And at 17, the boy turned to him and had to say this to him. Is what you believe really true, or is it just what you believe? And it stopped him in his tracks, and he had to think about it because he had become so familiar with his practice of his faith, with his church, with the theology, that he hadn't really thought about it. But here was his son intensely thinking about it and trying to decide if it was really true, if it was for him, if it was going to make any difference in this life that he was now embarking on. It's a healthy question, but it can't just be relegated to the 17-year-olds among us. All of us need to be asking this question of ourselves. What does it mean for me to say that I believe in God, and what difference does it make in my life? Is it just what I've always been taught? Is it just what I've always been told? Is it just what I grew up with and I'm now so familiar with that I'm sort of on autopilot, living off the capital of my youth? What is going on here? I grew up Catholic, and so I'm recovering from something too. The nuns of first through third grade and all of that. But you know what? My family was Catholic. I went through 12 years of Catholic school. At the end of 12 years of Catholic school, I joined a monastery because I thought that's what I wanted to do. And I have such vivid memories of those early times. And I remember what the nuns taught me. I remember all of this. And especially I remember how exciting it was to become an altar boy. I think that was like my crowning achievement in 6th and 7th grade, was to become an altar boy. And the first time I served Mass was just so exciting. And I remember getting up before dawn to get ready and ride my bike about the 5 miles to school and get there in the semi-darkness. And I remember going into the sacristy, and you go into this big closet that just looks so huge to me, with all of these robes hanging in there, and picking out one that fit me and putting on that long black cassock that snapped up the front and hung all the way to the floor, and then the white surplice that went on over that hung to my knees, and the smell when you open that closet of the fabric there that was filled with incense and the smell of candles and even sacramental wine as that was being poured out. And so all the smells were there. And I remember walking out onto the altar, and in the darkened church at 7 o'clock Mass on a weekday, there was probably about 15 people in the church, mostly elderly ladies. But the lights were dim, and they had these recessed down lights that just lit in pools of light around the altar and where we were kneeling. And we could choose either bells or books. If there was two of us serving, it was bells or books. Do you remember that, you recovering Catholics also? And so you sat on the book side, you sat on the bell side. And if you sat on the bell side, you get to ring the bell as the priest raised the host and raised the cup at the Eucharist. And if you were at the book side, then you held the big book. I mean, this sucker was huge. It was this big, it was that thick, and it was heavy. And you'd hold it for the priest so that he could turn the pages and say the liturgy of the Mass. I remember there's one taller priest who actually had us balance it on our foreheads and hold it like this. So we were kind of 4.5-foot human podiums there, but it was bizarre. A little demeaning, but we didn't care. We were just kids, you know? And I'll tell you what, I can still see, and if I shut my eyes, I can look into that gold-plated chalice. You know, it was literally a gold-plated cup with the sacramental wine in there being lit by the single beam of light that just looked like liquid gold. It was the most beautiful thing. And as a sixth grader, it was easy for me to imagine God was in the cup. You know, he was there. And that's what the nuns and the priests have been telling me anyway. You know, that literally the bread and the wine was being transformed into the body and blood of our Lord. And I looked at that. And then when he held that big host up and broke it, and I mean, all of those things were so graphic to me. And the memories to this day, 40 years later, are so solid and so clear. But you know, whatever passed for faith in my childhood did not survive my young adulthood. As clear as those memories are, you know, as strong as those images were and impactful as they were, when all of the twists and turns and hurts and traumas of my 20s set in, there was nothing left of that faith. It evaporated. And I went through about 13 years completely on my own in the wilderness until I then hit my bottom and decided I needed to turn around. You see, even through 12 years of Catholic school, and even through being an altar boy and everything that I'd learned, and even through my stint in the monastery, as short as it was, I hadn't really examined and explored my faith. It was there because it was what was always there in my life. It was there because it was familiar and comforting in certain ways. But I hadn't explored it. I hadn't really made it my own. And when the hard times came, it was gone. An unexplored faith is fragile. An unexplored faith can't bring us through difficult times. An unexplored faith doesn't give us the direct experience of God that makes us know that we know that we know that He is real. This isn't third person, third party information that comes to us anymore. This is direct experience. That's what Jesus is talking about. That's what the second step is talking about. Coming to believe in a power greater than ourselves, coming to believe in God, is not more head knowledge. It's not more of what you've been taught. It's an experience of a living presence that takes us someplace we've never been before so that we can choose in our lives to go someplace we've never been before. This is the kind of knowing. This is the kind of experience that we're talking about. And let's think about all the things in our lives that do derail us. I mean, there are serious things that go on. We look around and we see the uncertainty of the world. We look around and we see the traumas in our own lives, the deaths of people that are close to us, the senseless things that happen. I was just hearing on the radio that somewhere in L.A., a four-year-old child was hit by a stray bullet from a gang member. And this gang member was just out on parole, been in jail himself on and off since he was 10 years old, and some argument in a car, and he shoots a gun, and a four-year-old child is killed. I have a four-year-old child. I can't even imagine how I would feel at the senseless act, the senseless waste of life. I mean, you as a parent, how do you deal with something like that? How do you make sense of all the little things that had to happen? You know, the callousness about life that causes a four-year-old to be struck in the chest and to be killed. How do you deal with God then? Who is God then? How does God allow these kinds of things to happen? You know, there's a whole branch of theology called theodicy that deals with just this, the problem of evil in the world. And it goes kind of like this, that if God is all-powerful and God is all-good and yet evil exists in the world, then He's either not all good because He allows evil, or He's not all powerful because He allows evil. But He can't be both if evil exists. And this conundrum, this paradox, is responsible for so many people not ever getting to the point we're talking about, of true belief in God that allows them to trust Him enough to go into a direct experience. And then when these traumas and these tragedies occur, and you can't explain them, and because you haven't really experienced who God is, you can't survive them. Not with your faith intact. And this is where we need to go. This is what we're talking about here. And so what do? We try to prove God to ourselves, right? Have you heard all the proofs of God? Really, the rational proofs of God, and I've heard them over and over again, there are literally hundreds of them. If you really want to take a look at all of them. But they kind of break down into two general arguments. And one of them is the cosmological argument. And that one basically is the argument of first cause. And it says that, you know, if you look around at the universe and you see that time is moving in one direction and the universe, if it's expanding or whatever it's doing, if you roll that backward in time, there had to be a moment when something or someone had a first cause that created everything that we see now. It's logical, and it's a powerful argument, and you can say, yeah, okay. There had to be something that stood outside of space and time as we know it that initiated or started this whole thing rolling. That's a cosmological argument. There's another argument called the teleological argument. Another big Greek word there, but it comes from the word teleos in Greek that simply means the end or the purpose. And so basically what this is an argument from design. All right. If you look at the universe, if you look at our bodies and the intricate nature of human biology or any biology and the systems in the universe, seems to be design and purpose to it. And so if there's design and purpose to something, well then there's got to be a designer, someone who created something with purpose in mind. And so here's the two basic arguments, rational arguments for God. And so we try to turn to those. We try to tell us that we can prove God to ourselves. Many people would radically disagree with the statement I'm going to make, but I'm going to tell you that there's no way to rationally prove the existence of God. Can't do it. And think about why. How can our finite minds, using finite laws of physics, finite mathematics, and finite languages, ever describe the infinite? Something that by definition stands outside all of those systems that we just talked about. How can you do that? Something has to be left out. Something can't be described by definition. You can't prove the existence of God rationally to somebody else, but you can prove the existence of God to yourself, not by rational means, but by this direct experience we're talking about. There are so many clues in nature that tell us about the existence of God. You know, Cheryl gave me a DVD that talked about the various size of the planets and the stars and the cosmos, and then they went from macro to micro and started talking about the smallest pieces of our body, the very proteins that have purpose and design. And how could that possibly not be from a creator? But I'll tell you what, if you're not willing to believe, you can always find a rational way not to believe. You ever talk to someone who never believed that we actually went to the moon? That it was really shot somewhere on a soundstage at Area 51 or something like that, you know? And they've got some other conspiracy theory about JFK's assassination or about this or that or the 9/11 towers. And try to rationally explain to them and prove to them that we really did go to the moon. Once the mind is closed, once the mind is made up, game over, man. That's it. You're done. And if you don't want to believe in anything beyond your physical senses and rational logic and mathematics, you can do that. And no power on heaven and earth is going to change that. So here's the thing. AA has the solution. They say, you don't need to actually believe in anything right now. All you need to do is be humble and have an open mind. Humility and an open mind. With those two tools in hand, new worlds can open up to you. Think about what it means to be humble and to have an open mind. Think about the quality of a person who is carrying those two attributes with them wherever they go. And what does it start to sound like to you? We said last week that the person who finally admits their powerlessness is following Jesus' first step, which is the same as the AA first step, which is, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And that phrase, poor in spirit, meskina ruch, is an Aramaic idiom that simply means a person who is vulnerable, a person who is dependent, a person who has an attitude of poverty even if they're rich. And then Jesus says, unless you become like one of these little children, then you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. And the word he used there is talia, which not only means a child, but also a house servant. And you think about the qualities of those. The wonder, the enthusiasm, the exuberance of the child, the ability to take things just at face value, the dependence and the vulnerability, and then the willful submission of the slave or the servant. What does that start to sound like? Humility and an open mind. If we move into the attitude of Talia, the attitude of Meskina Ruch, if we move into the attitude of the humble and open-minded person, then everything becomes a teacher to us. And we can start to see the things that are hidden, that we think are hidden. You know, it's not about debating and apologetics and about all of these things that we try to fight with each other about to defend our views and to try to, without error, understand the nature of God, thinking maybe that somehow if I can just understand it well enough, then I can get the acceptance that I crave. That God will see me as meeting some standard that allows me, what, into heaven or avoidance of hell, or that I'm going to be blessed now in my life. But every time we try to stop or just use our rational mind, it's kind of a cop-out. It's an excuse not to move with abandon, with full extension into this direct experience. And I'll tell you what, a direct experience can be scary. You got to be willing to be the first one to pop your head up against the enemy lines, and be willing to lay down your rifle and walk across no man's land to the other side, all the time knowing that you could be shot at any moment. Are you willing to do that? Are you willing to take that perceived risk to find out if your God is a trustworthy God? It's scary sometimes. And so we hide behind our intellect. We hide behind these rational proofs, thinking that that's enough. But it's not if you want to experience what kingdom life is all about. If you want to truly see your lives change. God can't be proven just with our minds. And so, these first step tools allow and open doors to truth and possibility that we didn't have before. And what we find is, as we start to move into some direct experience, that God is not what we can ever speak or write or think or draw or in any way conceive. Every one of those things can be a beautiful image of God, but is not God himself. And there's an interesting thing to think about here, because the Hebrews, the ancient Hebrews, they disallowed, they absolutely forbade any images of God. They called them graven images. Are you familiar with that? Did not allow images to be drawn of God. Why? Because they knew as soon as you created the image, the danger was you were going to worship the image and not the God behind the image. You were going to fall short of this full experience of the God who can't be named. And to be named in Hebrew had an interesting understanding as well. To name something was to actually show dominion over that thing. Ever heard that before? When you named your child, you were showing dominion over your child. That was your child. You had the power to have dominion over them, to raise them. When Adam names all the animals in the garden, he's not just being able to call a giraffe a giraffe. In Hebrew understanding, God is telling the people, man has dominion over the animals because he named them. And this is why the Hebrews would never speak the name of their God. Because to speak the name of God was to show dominion over God. They wouldn't do that. And so we need to understand that when we try to name God, quantify him, put him in a box and stick a pin through him and put a glass case over him and understand him categorically and theologically and think that we know him, we're putting something, a barrier between us and the direct experience. Even Chinese philosophers said that the way that can be named is not the eternal way. They knew that as soon as you express it, you've changed it. And so the experience we're talking about is wordless. It's beneath our intellect or beyond it or over it or something. But when we really have those moments of connection with our God, we're not thinking about anything. And we're certainly not talking about anything. And if we tried, we couldn't express what it was that we experienced. There are no words. Oh, we try. We throw millions of words at it. But when it comes right down to it, how do you do that? And the danger is when you hear someone else express their experience of God, to think that that is God. And that you're supposed to recreate that experience somehow. And no, that's not the case at all. Our experience is our experience. And another thing that I just want to bring up here is that we seem to think, when we first start on our faith journey, you know that first love that you feel? That excitement that you feel, that you can't wait, you're just jumping out of your skin and you've got to tell everybody about it. You know, new Christians are usually pretty obnoxious anyway, because they just got to tell you, and they got to tell you how it is. Early Christians, and especially those in the 3rd and 4th century, understood these as called consolations. These are the consolations. These are what the feelings and the exuberance that God gave or allowed in the early parts of faith, where the flame was still kind of fragile and needed to be tended and guarded. But the idea was that you were supposed to grow beyond that. Counterintuitive, isn't it? We think that our faith should grow and have more and more of these kinds of feelings, have more and more of these visible and tangible connections with God. And yet, have you ever experienced that it goes just the other way? The ancients understood they were consolations. It was a honeymoon period, but the honeymoon was supposed to end, and you were supposed to move into a deeper level of faith. There's a wonderful story that I told last Wednesday at our last conversation about a young monk who enters a monastery, and he's so on fire for God in his newfound conversion and faith that he would literally levitate above his brothers at times of prayer in the chapel. And this went on and on and on, and finally the abbot comes to him and he says, "Get down, grow up, and join your brothers already." It wasn't supposed to stay that way. Sometimes we end up chasing the consolations, chasing the next emotional high, rather than realizing that as our faith deepens, as it grows more and more pure, it's as St. John of the Cross said in 12th century Spain, that it becomes a dark ray of faith, an almost imperceptible ray of faith, where all of the safety net seems to be removed. And yet, this is the deep understanding of faith. This is where God is trying to take us. And we can go there if we drop some of our preconceptions. Jesus said it best when he said at John 20:29, he said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." Because what did Thomas want? He wanted to see the hands and the feet. He wanted to see, and so that he could believe, so he could have that understanding. But blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. This is what's available to us. This is what belief is all about. Now, have any of you ever doubted your faith? You know what? I would say, I absolutely hope so. I really hope that at some point you have doubted your faith. Why? Think about courage for a second. Is courage the absence of fear? No. Courage is the ability to act in the presence of fear. If there's no fear, there's no courage. Right? Courage can only operate in the presence of fear. And it's the same with your faith. Is faith the absence of doubt? No. Faith is the ability to trust in the presence of doubt. Faith requires doubt to exist. It's like the oxygen that it breathes. Of course there's doubt. And what I would say to you, and what I've said to some couples that I've been counseling lately, when they're lamenting that they're fighting, I said, you know what? If you've never fought with somebody, you just don't know them well enough. Because once you get that close to somebody, there's going to be something that rubs. It's what you do with the fights that you have that makes the difference in the quality of your relationship. You know, if you haven't doubted your faith, then you're not taking your faith seriously enough. You're allowing yourself to stop at third-person knowledge. You're allowing yourself to stop at what's familiar. You're allowing yourself to rest somewhere short of this full extension and commitment that'll allow you to trust even in the presence of your doubts. You know, I was driving to church about a year ago, and it's when we were still over at the harbor. And I remember the day was pretty much like today. And I was driving along Antonio, where you're coming up to Ortega, where it's still kind of pristine, and you get this incredible view of the hills that go out to, the Ortega Pass and all that. And the light was just at this angle, and there was this mist that was clinging into the clefts of the hillsides. I couldn't imagine a more beautiful moment. And all of a sudden, the thought struck me: what if this is all there is? What if everything that I've dedicated my life to isn't real? What if just this beauty that I can connect with right now is the sum of what we have as human beings? That was a year ago, and it hit me so strong. And it stopped me for a second. And then in my next thought, I remembered that Jesus believed. And it just brought me right back. Because Jesus believed. He had a connection with his Father that was so one, it was so real, that he said, "Everything you see me do is as the Father does." And it brought me right back to just resting in his faith for a moment, because I didn't have enough of my own. But if we don't doubt, we're not going far enough. We need to push the envelope constantly, because we never exhaust God. There is always more. It's an infinite free fall into the center of God. And so I wanted to, as we look at the second part of step two, the knowing of God is what we're talking about. I wanted to read just this little excerpt that you'll find if you want to read along with me in the handouts. And it is three paragraphs from my book, so yes, it's a shameless plug. I admit it, and I'm sorry. But I just wanted to read this to you, because it expresses exactly what I wanted to say this morning. There's a kind of spiritual revelation that you can get from observing nature, named general revelation. And then there's a kind you can only get downloaded directly from God. That's special revelation. Observing nature can lead you to a personal belief in God. So you can say along with Abraham Lincoln, I can see how it might be possible for a man to look down upon the earth and be an atheist, but I cannot conceive how he could look up into the heavens and say there is no God. That's an expression of the cosmological argument. Or with Voltaire, if a watch proves the existence of a watchmaker, but the universe does not prove the existence of a great architect, then I consent to be called a fool. The teleological argument. So, through general revelation, we can develop a belief in God, but from that alone, we can't know Yada, know in Aramaic, him very well. We may be able to say through nature that God is certainly powerful, creative, even that he appreciates beauty and order, but in the deepest recesses of our humanity, all that misses the point. Albert Einstein was once asked what was the most important question his work could answer. He responded, whether the universe is a friendly place or not. That's it. Is the universe friendly? Is God friendly? Does he know me personally? Does he care what happens to me personally? These are the questions we really want answered. And nature and general revelation are no help here. Until we can answer these questions affirmatively, until we actually trust that our God is a friendly God, we're stuck. We get no further along the way. And since looking at nature is no help, we need God to speak and tell us directly how it is. That's it. The questions we want answered most deeply are the ones we can only get from this direct experience. And now you might ask me, how do I do that? Part of it is up to you to find out. About to find out. But if you just limit yourself to your prayer life, which is not really limiting yourself, but if you think that God can only be found in prayer, if you think that God can only be found here in times of worship, if you think that God can only be found in some sort of religious expression or experience, you're missing so much of what is really going on. And as I was finishing and trying to finish this message last night about 11:30, I finally took a break and checked my email, and an email came through that just hit me like a ton of bricks, because it was exactly what I'm trying to tell you right now. And it came from someone who's sitting here in this room right now. And listen to what he writes. He writes, my son was born. From the time he was just the size of a magical pin drop, he was growing in me. When my eyes first saw him, he was my life. He was everything that was good in me. He gave me love. He gave me everything. When I heard his voice, he told me, everything is okay now. We can grow up together. And grow and grow and grow. My child saved my life. My son teaches me how to live a life that is so full of love and peace and excitement. I now see things through his eyes whenever possible. He teaches me that everyone and everything is worth saying hello to. My son has given me amazing gifts. The same gifts that I gave my father. I see the twinkle in my father's eyes when he sees me. Now I understand where that twinkle comes from. Are you starting to get it? He has found the direct experience of God in his infant son. We can find the direct experience of God in every encounter and relationship and moment as we go through our lives together. There is no limit. There is no part of our lives not touched by God's Spirit. If we will just allow ourselves with humility and an open mind to find out that the universe is a friendly place, and then we are free to make the choices that will make our lives better, more connected each and every day. Let's pray. Father, I just want to thank you for this email that I got last night that just brought it all together for me. And I want to thank you for the man who wrote it and for his family and for his son. And I want to thank you for everything in each one of our lives that lets us know that you are real, that our belief in you is not paper thin but deep and orders our lives, that you care about us, that you will restore our lives to sanity if we can just come to you and connect with you. Help us to do that, Father. Help us to break through anything that we are still clinging to that keeps us from just falling in to this relationship with you, falling into your arms, falling into your embrace, and understanding how much we are loved, that there is really nothing to fear and nothing to risk, that this life that you have for us, this kingdom, is ours for the taking. We just have to accept that you are who you say you are. Thank you for all of this. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.